next presenter is Kay Esmiel. Following graduation from Florida State University, Kay traveled with her family as an Air Force wife for over 20 years. After a final tour in the interior of Alaska, where Kay directed a dance company, she settled here in Colorado Springs and earned her master's degree from UCCS. She went on to teach in the summer program for gifted children at Colorado College, and taught English in Academy District 20 for over 25 years. During Kay's professional career, she's combined her love of history and writing with a passion for theater. Working with students and colleagues, she's written and produced 6 original plays. Everybody Welcome was a play inspired by the work of Steve Antinuzio and his award-winning video about Fannie Mae Duncan, which of course was sponsored and produced by the Pikes Peak Library District. As Fannie Mae Duncan's biographer, Kay has completed a manuscript entitled Everybody Welcome, a Memoir of Fannie Mae Duncan and the Cotton Club. So we have the extreme pleasure of hearing from an innovative woman about a presentation on an innovative woman. So please help me welcoming Kay Esmiel.
Imagine, if you will, that it is a very hot summer in 1933, and a truckload of African Americans have just come into town from the backwaters of Oklahoma. Very few people noticed, but there was a very loud young woman at the back of that bunch in the truck, and it was Fannie Mae Duncan. She was Fannie Mae Bragg at the time. She actually was about 15. She'd missed some years of school because her father died. But when she came into town, she had big dreams. We didn't know that at the time, but she was destined to make her imprint on this city. And she did it several years later. She actually integrated our town peacefully to the riffs and the rhythms of jazz at her cotton club. When she first came, she entered North Junior High, and it was at that time desegregated, thanks to General Palmer, among the many things that he did for us. She and her sister Selena had never been to school with white students in their whole lives, and though they did make friends, they had the rare experience of seeing them only briefly in class because they had to run right down to Colorado Avenue, where they worked as underage waitresses at the Wallace's Cafe and Restaurant. The problem was that their mother had been widowed with 7 children, and so in that era, all the children went to work so that mother could stay at home. When she worked at the Wallace's, it was very close to the railroad depot behind the Antlers, and so hobos, remember, it's after the Depression, but still things were hard, as they have become again. And hobos would come up to the back alley where they could smell food, and she watched Mrs. Wallace hand out free food to transients. And Fannie Mae learned not only how to run a restaurant from Mrs. Wallace, but she also learned it's pretty important to be generous to people who are down and out on your luck. Fannie Mae went to Colorado Springs High School, and during the time she was there, she worked for Russian Count Benjamin Levkovsky. And it was the first time she was ever exposed to such opulence. There were crystal chandeliers, there were windows that stretched from the ceiling to the floor that were blown glass. And as she wiped down the marble-top tables, and she polished the silverware, she wanted those things for her own family, and she began to dream. Levkovsky was very interested in her because she was very ambitious, she was very bright, she knew math very well, and he became something of a mentor to her. While she was at the high school, she was a top athlete. She had to play basketball in a girls' club for black students because they didn't have one in the school. She also was the treasurer of a major club, and she was a top academic student as well. She was the first high school graduate in her family, and she was very proud of that. She fully intended to go to Langston College back in Oklahoma. Unfortunately, there wasn't money for that. As she put it, after high school, whites go to college, blacks go to work. So instead, she had to change her plans. And I have to tell you, it was a sad thing that she didn't get that dream. Lucky for us, she didn't. But her father had died when she was 8 in an automobile accident because he couldn't get adequate medical care. And so what she had wanted to do was be a nurse. Maybe we were lucky that instead she didn't have the money to go to college. What she did instead was accept a marriage proposal. Ed Duncan was a part of an established black family here and very respected, and whether you know it or not, we have quite a black aristocracy in our city. Ed was one of many athletes in the family, and he was 6 years older than she, so he had worked for 6 years for Mrs. D. Arthur Jones, who was a wealthy socialite down in the Broadmoor. Fannie Mae got a job right down the street, because she had to walk since he had the car, and she got it with District Attorney Earl Ford. District Attorney Earl Ford was very impressed with her, not only because she had a work ethic and she was very ambitious, but she also was able to maintain a confidentiality, and there were secrets that he didn't want known. She would have remained in this situation probably a bit longer, but December 7th, 1941, of course we all know what happened, those of us who are older, with the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Camp Carson at the time really began developing on the south end of town. And so Fannie Mae knew job opportunity. And she went out there and she was immediately selected after she passed the civil service exam with 99% as the manager of the soda fountain. It was actually at the Raven Club, which was for black soldiers because the military was segregated at the time. She was never satisfied though. And when she heard that the USO was going to open up a serviceman center on Colorado Avenue, oh, what an opportunity. And she just knew she could run that cafe and that snack bar. So she immediately began showing up, making appointments with city manager Earl Mosley. Mr. Mosley had no idea who this woman was, but she was quite aggressive. She wanted a business license because that was what was required, and he turned her down, even though she had these glowing letters of recommendation from both the district attorney and Count Lefkowski. She didn't know the reason was because she was only 26, and he couldn't imagine she could manage that much responsibility. Finally, after she had showed up week after week, day after day, he literally just quit turning her down and gave in. That's how she got the business license. And from the very beginning, she was successful because, of course, all the soldiers knew her from Camp Carson. And then because blacks, even though they got to eat in the lunchroom with kids when they were kids, once they became adults, they couldn't go into the restaurants to eat side by side. Interesting, isn't it? So she also had all the black clientele from the city. Meanwhile, her younger sister, the very beautiful Selena, had dropped out of high school, married a traveling musician, and had moved out to LA, where she visited with her husband because they went in separate directions most of the time. He was a traveling musician. She had a little boy named Sil, who was adorable. And she decided to work at a major LA nightclub as a waitress because she needed to supplement income. And there she was discovered as a vocal talent. First she sang with T-Bone Walker, and then she sang with Lionel Hampton's band as a vocalist. But it was really no place for a little boy growing up. So she asked Fannie Mae to come get her son, which she did. And Fannie Mae brought the little boy back. Ed was just really excited to have this little boy under his wing. And of course, he knew that they now were established at the USO concession with their cafe, and things were going well. He didn't know that Fannie Mae had only started. She wanted to find some sort of a building, because she had in mind that she wanted to have a major nightclub in the city. And lo and behold, one came available. It was the very building where she and her sister had been waitresses as young girls. The only problem was it was going to be $6,000, but she had that covered. What she was worried about was Ed, not the $6,000. She knew he would just about have a heart attack, and he most certainly did. Fannie Mae, where are we going to get that kind of money? Well, they had saved $3,000. That was half the battle, and she was sure she could get the rest. She asked her how, and she said, well, you know, Mrs. Arthur Jones, she loves you, Ed. I'm going to ask her if she'll loan us the money. And Ed was more than reticent, but he was also shocked when Mrs. D. Arthur Jones was persuaded, yes, indeed, to loan them the $3,000. And not only that, she said, drive us down there right now. Let's take care of this business. So they went to the Exchange National Bank. She walked in, sat in Jasper Ackerman's office, he was the vice president, and said, I'd like to write a check here for this family. I have a business venture. She wrote out a check for $3,000, handed it over to Fannie Mae. The rest is history. That was the beginning of the Cotton Club. The Cotton Club soon morphed into more than the Cotton Club. It wasn't the Cotton Club in the beginning. Looking at this picture, this is after she had all her businesses organized. But what happened initially was they opened a cafe and a bar in the bottom. And because she had been able to pull off getting $6,000 in a 24-hour period, she also got the liquor license. Now, blacks were only given one or two liquor licenses in the whole city. It was a way of centralizing them and kind of controlling where that population was going to be. And so she had a liquor license, which ultimately led to her being able to have a nightclub. But in addition to the cafe, she decided, well, young people need to be able to have a place to go. So she opened the Cherry Pit Barbecue on the back alley, which she had paved over. And then she kind of spilled over into the Dintan Printing Press building, so she bought it also. And then she opened a cigar store and a beauty parlor, and there was a two-chair barbershop, and then there was a gift shop, and there was, you name it, if you wanted to buy it, Fannie Mae would sell it to you. It was about this time that Chief Bruce came into the picture, and I'll show you why. Going back, see the big sign? That cost $4,200. She got it from the Link sign company. This is when Ed probably started drinking. It was 20 feet high, and in pink flamingo, it read, Cotton Club presents two lavish shows nightly, dining, dancing. Of course, she hadn't started booking the big names yet, but she and her husband had always gone up to the Russonian, where they did have big names in the black neighborhood, Five Points. So she made friends every time she went up there, and she met a guy, Leroy Smith, who was in charge of the Voters Club. And he booked big bands. So she began talking to him, saying, look, if you book them here and I tell them they can have an extra gig in Colorado Springs, we can get anybody, which they did. And soon, everybody was flocking to the Cotton Club because if you wanted to see the big names in town, she was the only game in town. Neither the Broadmoor or the Antlers would permit black entertainers in their hotels, either as guests or performers. So that's really why he came into the picture. Stogie smoking Dad Bruce. Dad Bruce told her, look, I hear that you're mixing colors at your Cotton Club. And she said, well, yes, they're doing it of their own. I check for their age, if they're 21. I didn't know I had to check for color, too. And he said, look, Penny Mae, run it black. And she said, well, you know, whites know their constitutional rights. Would you back me up if I do that? And he said, I said, run it black. This man was not accustomed to being confronted by anyone, much less a woman, and a black one at that. So, though she was disappointed, she agreed to run it black. However, by the time she got back to the Cotton Club, he'd already changed his mind because he knew he couldn't afford all those lawsuits. So he said, look, I don't care if they're black, pink, purple, blue, yellow, whatever. Let them in. Just make sure they're old enough. About that time, the great entertainers became performers at Fannie Mae's Cotton Club. It became the place to be, 25 West Colorado Avenue. People like Duke Ellington showed up on a regular basis. She had Earl Garner, Etta James, all the great black artists, because this was the only place in our city where you could see them. And as a result, everybody was going, including whites from Colorado College, affluent whites, people of all ethnic groups. And especially the soldiers were happy there because she'd hired 15 waitresses of every ethnic group she could think of. And people felt comfortable. There was always somebody else there that looked like you. Even though the black entertainers could come and perform here, they weren't welcome to stay here anywhere. So performers who were performing in the wee hours of the morning had to drive all the way back to the black neighborhood in Five Points to find a place to go to sleep. And Fannie Mae was really worried about that. What was going to happen? You know, she was afraid somebody would have a wreck, get killed. In addition to that, she was really disappointed in our city that we had so little hospitality toward the blacks. And so she heard through the grapevine, because she always had her ear to the grapevine. I think it was better than the Gazette in terms of information, that this big mansion was going to come for sale. It had been built in 1891 by Dr. James Hart, and he'd even used it as almost an infirmary when they had the influenza epidemic here. So she decided, perfect, 43 rooms, over 5,000 square feet, big enough for her, she thought. And so she purchased it, and she had now a lovely place for her family. Plus, now she had a place where she could offer accommodations for her black entertainers for a small charge, of course. When the house was finally moved over on the 6 lots that she bought on Corona, because it had to be moved from Nevada, it immediately was opened as a showplace, and blacks were very, very proud of this. But it wasn't just blacks who came here. Every dignitary who was in town either attended a tea or a reception or a fundraiser or something, which was sponsored by Fannie Mae. But the time that people walked through the house, they were really rather amazed. People even offered her money for some of the woodwork in the ceilings because it was all in old European style. She had all this beautiful woodwork in all the main rooms downstairs. There were crystal chandeliers downstairs. And she had bought that furniture she had dusted from all those years for Benjamin Levkovsky. She bought from him. She also bought crystal, silver candelabra, and she now had her mansion. The bed was big enough that Mahalia Jackson, when she came here, said, "Why'd you put me up with Broadmoor? I could have been sleeping here." Fannie Mae was concerned because her husband had become very alcoholic, and he had such ready access to alcohol at the Cotton Club. She had an idea. She always tried to solve problems by being able to make money, accommodate people, solve issues. And so her ulterior motive was really to put her husband as a manager of the Iron Spring Chateau. It came up for sale, and Mayor Mabel Willie, who was the Manitou Springs mayor, and pretty formidable lady too, I understand, sanctioned it. She thought it was a great idea, and it would bring tourists in, and she knew that Fannie Mae could bring in these big names. And so she agreed to it, but oh boy, the citizens of Manitou Springs were not happy about the possibility of what they considered a nightclub being opened in their Iron Spring Chateau. They didn't know that Fannie Mae could not get a second hard liquor license. It was not permitted by law. And so her idea was that she would turn the upstairs into a dance hall for all the young people because she wouldn't be serving liquor. And then downstairs, she intended to have a very nice restaurant, a gift shop, a dress shop that catered to tourists because they would be going past her chateau on their way to the Cog Railroad. Perfect. Unfortunately, as I said, the residents of Manitou Springs did not take to this idea at all. And they began protesting. They put all sorts of flyers under windshields and demanded that this not happen. They even stormed City Hall and even overcame the formidable mayor, Mabel Willie. And so even though her white lawyers screamed racism and tried to stand up for Fannie Mae, she finally acquiesced and just gave in to the public outcry. She said, "If they don't want me, I don't want to be there." It was a sad thing because what people did not realize was that it probably would have been a wonderful facility. And she was always very obedient toward the law, quite contrary to all the rumors I'm sure you have heard, but I did know her personally 12 years, so I can tell you they aren't true. And it would have probably sustained for a long period of time and might still be there as it was. But what happened was that she gave in, and then, sadly to say, just months later in January of 1955, her husband died of alcoholism. So she had to bounce back. But she did. She was only 36 years old, but she didn't stop. The local businessman may have thought she was over, that the Fannie Mae Duncan story had ended, but they were quite wrong. Selena had come back, and she became the house singer for Fannie Mae, and of course everybody wanted to hear Selena. And in addition to Selena, of course, because Selena had sung with Lionel Hampton, she could get him almost any time. He came back every chance he got, and so the Cotton Club continued to thrive. Young entertainers, and yes, B.B. King and I were once young, we're very glad to go there because she had an ace in the hole with young entertainers who were very lonely on the road and missed mama's home cooking. Mama. Her mama. Maddie Bragg was her ace in the hole. Maddie had a vegetable garden. She fixed those collard greens and vegetables and all that down-home cooking that the kids loved. B.B. King always would come, mainly because of mama. Fannie Mae also was very philanthropic. She was a community activist and also an entrepreneur, all the things you've heard and more. And she always made sure that she gathered food and money for the poor when it was necessary. And kids always got toys every Christmas, whether they were poor or not. When her brother's little boy 7-year-old Gregory Bragg, and Vernon's in the middle, and his wife Doris next to her, died of bulbar polio, the first victim of that year in Colorado Springs. Fannie Mae was crushed. She believed that all children should get their chance, as she called it, because she'd gotten hers. And so she called in Mahalia Jackson, who's down at the bottom here, the great gospel singer, and said, would you please come to Colorado Springs and perform at the City Auditorium, a benefit so we can buy an iron lung for the city. And of course, Mahalia agreed. By the time they had enough money for the iron lung, Salk had created the vaccine. And so instead, the Denver Medical Research Center was the beneficiary of a lot of money. So many things happened at the Cotton Club. She ran it for 20 years all by herself, well, with the help of her family and Selena, of course. But the thing about it was, here she had helped to integrate the city peacefully. But once civil rights had its all victory, its big victories, it created the demise for her club, one of the ironies of life. Because once blacks could perform anywhere or go into any facility, there really was no need for the Cotton Club as it had been, and she was no longer the only game in town. So the woman who actually sold it to her, Alice Douglas, when she sold it, she predicted that if whites ever got hold of that property, blacks would never own it, any land in the center of the city again. It came true in 1975 because the Cotton Club was razed to the ground. Now, you might think that is the end of the Fannie Mae Duncan story, but not really. She left us two words, everybody welcome, because that was her philosophy. Once people realized they could go in her club, they didn't pay any attention to the fact who was sitting next to them. They just enjoyed the talent. She combined everybody's love of art to bring us together. And in giving us the two words, everybody welcome, finally the Cultural Diversity Festival picked it up. They've just gotten a major award from the National Black Caucus for this Cultural Diversity Festival. And she reminded us, you know, if we could just use those two little words, which is kind of a paraphrase of the Golden Rule, probably Colorado Springs would be the most popular city in the whole United States. So I leave you with her two words. Remember, why don't you try to make everybody welcome?
Our final speaker of the day is Tim Blevins. Tim has been the manager of special collections for the Pikes Peak Library District since September of 2001, where he is responsible for the regional history and genealogy collections housed in the historic 1905 Carnegie Library. Tim studied photojournalism at New Mexico State University, and he earned an undergraduate degree in journalism and mass communications. He later earned a master's in library and information science from the University of Texas at Austin. Today, he is pulling off the seemingly impossible task of being our co-chair for this wonderful symposium and also presenting a paper entitled Marketing a Messiah, Denver's Divine Healer and His Inspiration of Entrepreneurs. Please welcome Tim Blevins.
Well, good afternoon again. I appreciate you all sticking it out. I'm wondering here, well, first I want to tell you this is a really tough spot, such poised speakers that preceded me. I won't be quite as poised, but hopefully we'll be entertaining, and if not, don't tell me about it. I don't have a very thick skin. Who here has heard of Francis Schlatter, the Divine Healer of Denver? I'm just curious. So, well, you were kind of like me. Most of you haven't heard of him. I had no idea who this man was. And I won't tell you the story of how I first covered it or discovered him, but I'll give you a little hint. I was working on illustrating the William Jackson Palmer book and was going through the Library of Congress photo archives. They have a great archives online. And came across these photographs of this man. And just long story short, I thought, well, this is somebody I'd like to know more about. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about him today. And then you'll perhaps understand a little bit more about why I titled my talk this. The illustrations primarily in this presentation come from the Library of Congress. However, I do have some great photographs that were provided by the collection of Ed and Nancy Botke, and I appreciate that. One of my observations when I started to learn about Francis Schlatter is that he would take no money for doing his healing services. And so when he went to Denver, I started to see this pattern develop. This pattern was a lot of people were making a lot of money when he wasn't making a penny. And I thought, well, that's kind of, I don't know what that is. So I decided to do a little research on what that might be. So I'll start my story. On July 22nd, 1893, when the Rocky Mountain News reported that the police were searching for a Denver shoemaker who had mysteriously disappeared from his home at 1848 Downing Avenue. A note was found in his shop, which read, "To the world, meet me in the backyard." The missing shoemaker was Francis Schlatter, who emigrated from New York City in 1884 from Alsace-Lorraine, then part of the German Empire. He became a naturalized U.S. citizen in 1891. Schlatter moved to Denver in September of 1892, and he set up a shoe repair business in a tiny storefront on Downing Avenue. Until July of 1893, and that's when he heard the voice of God who told him to leave Denver. For 730 awful superhuman days of awful superhuman endurance, he listened to the voice and followed every command. It led him mostly on foot as far east as Hot Springs, Arkansas, west to California, and finally to Albuquerque, New Mexico. During his travels, the voice told Schlatter that he could heal the sick. And in Albuquerque, he attracted a very large crowd. Schlatter accepted no money for his healing, insisting that the results were not from his own powers, but the work of God. Edward L. Fox, who was a Denver alderman and an owner of a coal and grain supply, persuaded Schlatter to return to Denver. So leaving Albuquerque on an Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe train on August 21st, 1895, Schlatter was met by crowds along the Santa Fe route to Cerrillos, Lamy, Trinidad, and La Junta. The Santa Fe route was proud to promote that theirs was the only railroad that Schlatter ever traveled. And this is an advertisement of that fact. He arrived in Denver on August 22nd, weak, weary, and sick. Despite the persistent crowds gathering to receive Schlatter's powers, word came that he would not perform any healing for the people of Denver for at least 3 weeks. He resumed healing on September 16th from the Art of the Fox residence at 625 Witter Street. Perhaps this was the backyard that he intended to meet the world. Isn't this incredible, the number of people? News of Schlatter's healing ability spread quickly, and thousands of people traveled to the Fox residence to receive his healing blessings. Several prophets, visionaries, messiahs, and tramp healers had made international news during the mid-1890s, but 39-year-old Francis Schlatter was different. Unlike most other divine healers, Schlatter remained in this one Denver location for many weeks. He attracted enormous crowds, and he spurned offers of money. This act of apparent unselfishness secured his credibility in the minds of believers. "I have no use for money," Schlatter said. "The Father will take care of me." Many factors may have contributed to the divine healer's success. The new millennium was approaching, and some prophecies told of a second coming of Christ. When asked by a reporter, Schlatter confirmed that he was Christ. He looked like Christ, represented in the centuries of art. He had long, dark brown hair and steel gray eyes, and always focusing up towards the heavens. The Rocky Mountain News reported, "Accepting his emaciated appearance, he bears some resemblance to the pictures of the Savior, whom Schlatter claims to be." In most all of the photographs of Schlatter, his eyes are turned upward in an attitude of humble supplication. Psychologists were convinced that Schlatter believed that he was Christ. After opinions were published in the Denver papers claiming that Schlatter was actually the Antichrist, Edward Fox stated that Schlatter does not claim to be Christ. To me, he avers that he is nothing but a poor, ignorant man. Schlatter didn't preach. He was a man of few words. The few sentences that he uttered were slightly seasoned with a German accent that were said to be with a pronunciation that baffles the imagination. Nationally, the newspapers reported on the testimonies of successful cures received by those who were touched by Schlatter. The blind man who could now see, the deaf woman who could now hear, and the crippled girl who could now walk were all common confirmations of Schlatter's effectiveness. Claims also stated that Schlatter cured liver abscesses, relieved the effects of tuberculosis, and diminished other serious diseases. These affirmations swelled the daily numbers of those seeking help from him from hundreds to thousands. The Rocky Mountain News reported, "It is well worth the time of any thinking person to take a trip to North Denver in order to look upon the miscellaneous gathering here assembled." Not all of the reported news was favorable. The Institute for the Deaf and Blind in Colorado Springs, having been refused a healing visit from Schlatter, reported that not a single treatment was beneficial to those from the school who went to see him in Denver. A crowd of 3,000 was gathered for Schlatter's divine treatment on October 19th. Where there is a crowd, there's money to be made. Some were fortunate to find rooms for rent in nearby residences, enabling them to rise at the first break of dawn to secure the first places in line. A large tent was erected in a lot near the Fox home. One could rent a bed outside of the tent for $2. A thriving little town, including restaurants, sprang up, forming a white city of sailcloth tents. The fire department ordered the tents out as they violated the city ordinance. Schlatter himself insisted the owner remove the tent with the rented beds. He would not allow any person to rob the unfortunate. When the crowd learned of Schlatter's contempt for the recalcitrant owner, 50 men leveled the tent to the ground. Handkerchiefs blessed by Schlatter were thought to possess sufficient curative power that they would provide results for those who were distant from Denver or who could not travel. A man who chose to remain anonymous stood in line with a bedsheet that he wished to have blessed. "I am much interested in the powers of Francis Schlatter," he said. A neighbor's wife had her handkerchief blessed a week ago with the hope that it would moderate her ungovernable temper. Her husband reports me a remarkable cure. "I'm after the same cure for my wife. And I brought a bread sheet instead of a handkerchief." Reportedly, at Schlatter's request, Edward Fox swore out an arrest warrant for a John Doe, who for $1 was selling handkerchiefs printed with the likeness of the healer and which the seller declared had been blessed by Schlatter. The man reaped a big harvest among the crowd, and he was taken into custody. Three men were charged with selling fraudulent blessed handkerchiefs purporting they cured any disease, conducting a thriving business at their shop on 15th Street. The accused were Dan Hanley, Thomas O'Connor, and saloon keeper Daggert. Their case was dismissed after Schlatter did not appear as a principal witness. Regarding the purchasers of the fraudulent handkerchiefs, Schlatter was reported to have said, and this is as it was written in the newspaper in literal vernacular, "Those people was fools. When they pay for a handkerchief, don't make it no good. Water will not bless such things. They should think for themselves. Even if I have them in my hands, when they sell them, nobody gets well." Handkerchiefs printed with Schlatter's image were also used to advertise, and this is an example of one used for the De Leon Solomon store in Albuquerque. Francis Schlatter's name and fame were used in other advertising. For example, J.T. Fitch, who was in the boot and shoe business, ran an ad, "Schlatter outdone in Aspen. You can be healed while you wait," H-E-E-L-E-D. Just wait. "I will also look after the welfare of your souls." Skinner Brothers, or Skinner Brothers and Wright Company, promised a souvenir Francis Schlatter cyclist with every $5 purchase. The cyclist was a small booklet with a poetic story about Schlatter in Denver. Other books about Schlatter were sold in stores and by mail order. Photographs of Schlatter could be purchased by mail order as well. William A. White of Raton, New Mexico, succeeded in taking Schlatter's photograph and sold the cabinet cards for 25 cents. Photographing Francis Schlatter was apparently a difficult task. Schlatter told a Denver reporter, "They tried to take a picture of me with the camera three times at Albuquerque." You notice his English has gotten a lot better. "I told them to go ahead and get the picture if they could. I knew they wouldn't. The glass snapped three times. The father did not want them to have it, and they didn't get it." Schlatter at first refused to pose, but finally the thrifty picture man, Mr. White, gained the friendship of Mr. Schlatter. And Schlatter refused to sit for any other photographer. And that resulted in White's exclusive good thing. He expected to be able to exploit this good thing for those waiting in Chicago for Schlatter to arrive. When a reporter asked his opinion, this is White, of Schlatter, White said, "I'm not saying anything, but I have told my intimate friends that I believe he is crazy." You can see here, this is just a blow-up of the previous photograph. This man is clearly holding photographs, possibly selling them. In doing this paper, a lot of the things I looked for in the photographs led me to believe there was a lot of entrepreneurial activity going on here. And so I'll point out a few of those things. For a price, one waiting to see Schlatter could purchase aromatic coffee, hot soup, and donuts. There was a hot tamale man and a popcorn vendor and a man selling souvenirs. And here's the man selling souvenirs. The lemonade, popcorn, and watermelon merchants made the air ring with their cries and gathered in nickels and dimes with swiftness. Nothing was lacking in refreshment. A lunch counter opposite the Fox Cottage was kept busy supplying hot coffee and sandwiches to the hungry. Crowds of people who have visited Heeler Schlatter from time to time have caused vendors to appear in the vicinity with curious wares. Yesterday, the limit of peddler's ingenuity was reached when an entertaining individual announced to the long line of waiting people that for a nickel apiece, he would furnish them with hot bricks. As the day was cold, the bricks went like hotcakes. Also, enterprising Fox neighbors got into the game by renting chairs. They did a good and profitable business, offering a restful place for those in line to sit. One morning at daylight, four boys took places in line that they later sold to four men for $9. This scalping offended Schlatter, who insisted the men give up their purchase to places in line. There were Schlatter skeptics who did not believe, not necessarily that they did not believe in Schlatter's healing abilities, but they really didn't understand how he could provide his services for no personal benefit. Some speculated that he was receiving money in secret, or that there were those supporting Schlatter's efforts who were somehow reaping a fortune. Edward Fox, in whose home Schlatter was living, was suspected of receiving $50 a day from the Denver City Cable Railway Company. The Rocky Mountain News quoted the company owner, Colonel George E. Randolph, who said, "We would be very glad to make a handsome present to Mr. Fox or the healer either, but I see no way of making the present. Our company has profited thousands of dollars by the presence of Schlatter in North Denver, and of course we are very thankful." The Denver Post reported, "There is one feature of the healer's stay in Denver that has deeply interested the railroads, and that is the increase in passenger business. All of the railroads report a great number of passengers who sole, S-O-L-E, business is to visit the Denver attraction." A prominent railroad man was reported to say, "It would be a good thing for our business should Schlatter remain in Denver, but the railroads entering into Chicago are going to be reaping the big profits." Schlatter was visited on November 12th by a committee of businessmen from Omaha who were intent on getting Schlatter to heal in their city. Though these men may have had noble interest in Schlatter's apparent healing gift, it's probably occurred to them that an attraction like Schlatter could have positive profitable benefits as well. Schlatter disappeared again on November 13th, 1895. A simple note for Edward to Edward Fox said, "Mr. Fox, my mission is finished. Father takes me away. Goodbye." There's no way of knowing, but it was reported that Schlatter treated between 50 and 87,000 souls in Denver, with more than 200,000 gathering near the Fox home to scrutinize him during his 6 weeks there. The population of Denver at the time was less than 164,000. Charlatan Schlatters started to appear just one day after his disappearance from Denver. A young man claiming to be Francis Schlatter appeared in Beatrice, Nebraska, about 50 miles south of Lincoln. Perhaps the news of Omaha's desperate bid for Schlatter to visit was adequate incentive for an equally desperate imposter. Soon other charlatans claimed to be Francis Schlatter. For weeks, Schlatter's sightings were published in newspapers. Some reported that he was in Golden. Others reported that he was near Elizabeth riding a white horse. Some reported that he was in New Mexico, and others found him in Arizona. News from Chicago stated that letters received from Schlatter himself indicated his certain arrival on November 30th. One newspaper story jokingly stated that Schlatter was already in Chicago curing hams. Rumors of Schlatter's death started to appear in the news during early June 1897. Credible accounts reported that a man fitting Schlatter's description was found dead near Casas Grandes, Chihuahua, Mexico, and that a white horse, a copper rod, which he was known to carry, and a Bible with Francis Schlatter's name written in it were among the deceased's belongings. A newspaper reported, no healer in modern times has aroused so strong a belief in his power or won as large a following. And still numerous Schlatters, now traveling throughout the West, are gaining the pecuniary benefit of the dead man's notoriety. Remarkably, at least to me, charlatan Schlatters were claiming to be the divine healer for more than two decades after Francis Schlatter was reportedly found dead in Mexico in 1897. Francis Schlatter imitators seized the opportunity to fill the void of Schlatter's absence. Some of them are pictured here. Four categories of impersonators emerged. There were impersonators of circumstance, those who did not claim to be Francis Schlatter, but who were identified as the man by others. There were imposters who fraudulently assumed the identity of Francis Schlatter, the most common. There were dual identity imposters who claimed their own identity as well as the identity of Francis Schlatter. And there were imposter teams, partners, sometimes portraying the Schlatters as husband and wife, who cooperated to reinforce their divine healing claims. The Francis Schlatter knockoffs and con artists had one common goal, to make a buck. Thank you.